KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in False Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal leaders and elected officials are celebrating the establishment of two national monuments in California by President Joe Biden, the Chuckwalla National Monument and the Satitla Highlands National Monument. Together, they will protect 848,000 acres of lands, which include tribal cultural and sacred sites. The Tribal Council of the Fort Yuma Quetzalan Indian Tribe in a statement said, the protection of the Chuckwalla National Monument brings their people an overwhelming sense of peace and joy. U.S. Senator Alex Padilla in a statement said, it's another victory for safeguarding California's public lands for generations to come. Tribal leaders are also calling on President Biden to designate one more national monument in California before the end of his term, the proposed Quetzalan National Monument. Tribal leaders and California state lawmakers held a press conference in Sacramento last fall, urging President Biden to designate all three national monuments in the state. Native American California Assembly member James Ramos, during the press conference, talked about the significance of the areas to tribes.
By designating these areas, it's not just designating a monument. To us as Indian people, it's a way of life and protecting our lives of our ancestors and who we are and for future generations to move forward.
Alterina Santiana, secretary of the Torres Martinez Desert Cahuilla Indians, was among tribal leaders to speak at the press conference.
We want it to be where our ancestors, they were able to enjoy it and live in it. And we also want that for the present and for the future generations, where we can also share this with our communities that are in our surrounding areas. We can educate and we can teach about our culture.
President Biden is expected to sign proclamations Tuesday creating the Chuckwalla and Satitla National Monuments. January is National Human Trafficking Prevention Month. In South Dakota, the push to secure justice for missing and murdered Indigenous women remains a priority, but some advocates are seeking more resources. The issue has garnered more attention at the national level in recent years, including the 2023 launch of an outreach program led by federal authorities. South Dakota is a host district for one of the handful of U.S. attorneys assigned to the effort. While the extra leadership might be helpful, Tanya Grassel-Critlow with the South Dakota Network Against Family Violence and Sexual Assault says there is still not enough funding to accelerate meaningful progress.
We are desperate for funding. And then without funding, we are not able to provide advocacy to work with the families of the missing and to work with the potential victims who we've identified through a lot of factors who have the potential to become missing.
She spoke during a recent forum hosted by the South Dakota Humanities Council. Panel members also said agencies still do not share enough intelligence to prevent crimes. Funding came up during a congressional hearing last fall, and a key lawmaker pledged a bigger level of support moving forward. But it's unclear what that will look like when budget negotiations resume in the spring. Lily Mendoza leads the Red Ribbon Skirt Society based in Rapid City. She says federal officials have improved their listening efforts when grassroots groups speak out on the issue. And she says they see good relationships with local law enforcement, but her team still has to fill in gaps to ensure accountability.
You know, I got a call from a parent. They're concerned about their child. Can you check into this? So those systems that the Not Invisible Act is supposed to be putting in place, the grassroots organizations are taking that on.
Mendoza applauds a specialized federal unit that launched in 2021 that can more freely navigate the country to look into these cases. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Skuktash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods, tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Om Nye.
educators. Ready to transform Indigenous education? The NISN School Design Fellowship is accepting community letters of interest through January 31st at nacainspiredschoolsnetwork.org, who support this show.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
When a bird like a MERS hit, I mean, you know something's really haywire in the big picture.
Citizen scientists in the Aleutians helped document the largest die-off of a single species ever recorded. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, January 7th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, sea ice forming later in Kotzebue Sound impacts travel in the Northwest Arctic.
We do depend on good solid freeze-up cycles and thaw-out cycles for safe travels to and from.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If domestic violence has touched your life, know that you are not alone. You have the power to break free and build a future filled with love and respect. There's hope and help waiting for you. For free and confidential support, visit notaloneak.org to speak to someone who's trained to help. Every Alaskan deserves to feel safe. This message sponsored by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
The federal government will open envelopes Friday to see who's bid on oil and gas leases to a portion of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The state of Alaska has been a steadfast champion of drilling there, but on Monday, the state filed a lawsuit seeking to invalidate the lease sale. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin explains why.
The lawsuit says the Biden administration is offering so little land for lease and has put so many restrictions on it that the lease sale doesn't comply with the law. That would be the 2017 tax law. After decades of hot debate in Congress, Senator Lisa Murkowski championed a provision in that law mandating two lease sales of at least 400,000 acres each on the coastal plain of the refuge. The first was held in 2021 in the final days of the Trump administration. None of the big oil companies offered a bid. Two private firms won leases, but then relinquished them. The main bidder was the state-owned Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. Then the Biden administration canceled the leases, saying the process was flawed. So the state says it's not even fair to say this week's lease sale is the second. And the state says the Biden administration designed the lease sale to discourage fossil fuel development rather than encourage it. The administration offered only a third of the coastal plain for lease. Worse, the state says even if a company wins a lease, the restrictions on surface use and occupancy of that land make development impossible. The lawsuit asks a U.S. District Court judge to block the Biden administration from issuing any leases resulting from this week's sale. The Biden administration says its restrictions are the best way to balance all of the laws it has to follow. Before the 2017 law ordering lease sales, Congress set other goals for the Arctic Refuge, including conserving birds and wildlife and protecting subsistence hunting and fishing opportunities. If the lawsuit succeeds, the Trump administration could get a do-over to offer more land for lease and under terms that would make it easier to fulfill Donald Trump's mission to drill, baby, drill. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Nearly a decade ago, bird observers in Unalaska noticed something alarming. A once abundant seabird was vanishing from their shores. Now, scientists say the common murre experienced the largest single-species wildlife die-off ever recorded. KUCB's Sophia Stewart-Rossi reports on how citizen scientists have become crucial as human-caused climate change intensifies.
Waves are crashing against Front Beach in Unalaska, and Megan Dean grips her binoculars, counting birds in the bay.
One, two, three, four.
She's counting them as they bob the waves, making sure she counts all of them before they dive underwater.
10 more black scoters. We have a couple of cormorants.
Dean is part of Unalaska's Christmas Bird Count, a winter tradition that's now in its fourth decade. 18 people spent one December morning outside tallying every bird they could find. It's part of the Audubon Society's nationwide count that helps scientists track changes in bird populations.
Is that just to get out in the winter and like have a greater purpose? A good citizen science project to get you through the dark days.
The largest bird populations in Unalaska's 2024 Christmas count are black scoters, harlequin ducks, glaucous winged gulls, and of course, the famous bald eagle. But one notable bird is missing, the common murre. And a new study says its absence represents a catastrophic rippling effect that occurred in Alaska's waters. Not a single common murre was spotted in Unalaska's Christmas bird count. And that might not sound alarming, but locals counted more than 4,000 of them in the 2009 Christmas bird count, from 4,000 to zero in 15 years. In 2014, a marine heat wave struck and their numbers started plummeting. Scientists link the heat wave to human-caused climate change. Susie Golodoff compiles Unalaska's annual Christmas bird count and has spent nearly 50 years observing the island's birds as a naturalist.
Sometimes you see small populations of birds, they become more and more vulnerable and they become extinct. And you can sort of see how that would happen. But when a bird like a murre is hit, I mean, you know something's really haywire in the big picture.
Golodoff says these birds played a crucial role in Alaska's marine ecosystem. Big populations of the common murre help recycle nutrients through the ocean. They feed on small fish and nested colonies with thousands of seabirds packed together on narrow cliff ledges. In those numbers, their calls create a wall of sound. Golodoff takes out her phone.
So that's a murre.
That's the colony. So you could imagine being up in the Pribilofs after these. You multiply that by thousands.
Golodoff says she loves the sound of the common murre. And she says she misses hearing them during the summer in Unalaska while out fishing in her skiff or hiking around the island. Statewide, Alaska used to be home to a quarter of the species' world population, 8 million common murres. Scientists in a new study say the heat wave, also known as the blob, disrupted their food web in the North Pacific Ocean. 4 million common murres starved to death in the largest single-species wildlife die-off ever documented. Heather Renner is that study's lead scientist. She says the discovery felt like a gut punch.
We can't stop heat waves without mitigating climate change, but I think there's lots of things we can do to protect vulnerable species, and I think the urgency of them becomes a lot more relevant.
The murre die-off might have gone unexplained if it weren't for decades of observations from researchers and citizen scientists. Renner says they pieced together what happened using 50 years of data, including records from a coastal regional citizen scientist group that have been documenting dead birds washing up on their beaches for decades.
Those data have been tremendously important in understanding what's normal and helping us document what's not normal.
Renner says local observers who collect data, like from the Christmas bird count, help scientists spot problems early. She says when locals notice something unusual, it can signal researchers to take a closer look.
People are on the ground living with these wildlife, living close to them, and that information from the people who live near them is really urgent.
For now, the count continues.
Hey, Mo, do you want to see if there's any birds in all this trash down here?
In Unalaska, I'm Sophia Stewart Rossi.
So we have...
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Bethel librarian receives a national award.
I really love serving this community. I feel like I get to see people from all across the community every single day when I'm at work.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
How does Alaska's land fund community services for Alaskans with behavioral health conditions and developmental disabilities? Through the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. The Trust Land Office manages 1 million acres of lands to maximize revenue generation, with earnings supporting millions of dollars in trust grant making each year to help improve mental health outcomes for beneficiaries statewide. More at alaskamentalhealthtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
Anchorage police shot and hospitalized a man today, officials say. In a dispatch, Anchorage police said the man was shot near the 500 block of West Northern Lights Boulevard just before 2 p.m. Officials had little additional details to offer, noting that the man was taken to the hospital with life-threatening injuries. Police requested that residents avoid the area as they conduct their investigation. APD officials declined to provide additional details Tuesday afternoon. This marks the first person shot by Anchorage police this year. Last year, officers shot 8 people, 5 of whom died. Police Chief Sean Case said it was the highest number of shootings by police he's seen in his more than 20-year tenure with the department. Arctic sea ice is forming later each year. Researchers say this fall, ice coverage reached a near historic low. Now, as winter sets in, local observers and researchers say fall storms may have caused much thinner ice conditions than normal. And as KUTZ's Desiree Hagen reports, the thin sea ice can have wide-reaching repercussions.
Cyrus Harris remembers the late October storm that hit the Northwest Arctic.
That caused, you know, one of the bigger floods in this area, affected many people mentally, physically, and there was a lot that was lost. Suddenly it's 10 feet higher than what it was. You know, it was not an easy moment.
The flooding in Kotzebue displaced 60 residents and caused widespread damage, with 2 families losing their homes. Climatologists say fall storms in the region are becoming more intense and frequent because of human-caused climate change. Harris says the autumn storms and flooding, along with changes in wind patterns, might have another effect: thinner sea ice that forms later in the year. Research backs this up. A recent study in the northern Bering Sea found that record thin ice during the winter of 2018-2019 may have had longer ecological effects. Researchers linked the scarcity of ice to harmful algal blooms, a northern migration of predatory fish like Pacific cod, and widespread marine mammal and bird die-offs. Harris says on Kotzebue Sound, freeze-ups are coming about 45 days later than historic averages. He says the thin ice impacts travel, as many people in the region use snow machines to travel over solid sea or river ice between villages.
We do depend on good solid freeze-up cycles and thaw-out cycles, you know, for safe travels to and from. But now we're learning a new thing, is the freeze-up cycles are happening much later.
Rick Toman is a climate scientist with the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Toman says this year's late ice isn't unique to the Northwest Arctic. He talked to KOTZ in mid-December.
This is all part of a bigger picture. For the last week now, the sea ice extent for the Arctic as a whole, so the entire Arctic, is the lowest of record for this point in the season.
Toman says the fall storms and warm weather in the region likely contributed to ice forming later. He says by mid-December, most of the region's shorefast ice hadn't set up yet. Toman says the shorefast ice is a barrier, and the sooner the ice forms, the better.
You know, every day we don't have ice is one less day it has to thicken up.
Bobby Schaefer is a retired fisherman and an observer with the Alaska Arctic Observatory and Knowledge Hub, and a longtime local.
I made a hole yesterday. You know, it's 14 inches out here. Normally it's, you know, 4 to 5 foot back in the day when December was one of our coldest months, and we barely got below zero this year.
Like Schaefer, Cyrus Harris says later sea ice formations are becoming the new normal in the Arctic.
You know, we observe and watch the temperatures. It's a lot that our elders before us, you know, pay us attention to, is the ice formation, that the time of the year. But now, with all these changes, you know, it could start forming, give it a couple of weeks, and it's not there anymore.
These days, Harris is in a role like the elders he grew up listening to. And he says, now, already into January, he's still observing and waiting for the ice to thicken up. In Kotzebue, I'm Desiree Hagen.
In mid-August, coastal communities on the Kuskokwim Delta were hit by a string of storms that brought widespread flooding to the western part of the state. As KYUK's Evan Erickson reports, last week, the tribe representing one of those communities became the second ever in Alaska to receive a federal disaster declaration to recoup their losses.
In August, flooding brought on by heavy rains, high winds, and tidal forces caught Western Alaska coastal communities off guard and drew comparisons to the impacts of Typhoon Murbach a little less than 2 years earlier. In Kipnuk, a lower Kuskokwim Delta community of roughly 600 people a short distance inland from the Bering Sea coast, the flooding was especially severe.
This August storm compared to the Typhoon Murbach was more impactful and it done a lot of damages.
That's Raina Paul, environmental director for the native village of Kipnuk.
I thought it was way too early. We're starting to see these extreme storm events happen more often and way early.
She says floodwaters inundated multiple homes in the lower part of the community, floated away boardwalks, and toppled bins used to collect raw sewage. Paul says she scrambled to compile photos of damage to infrastructure from the August storms. With assistance from the nonprofit Alaska Institute for Justice, she got the ball rolling on applying to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, for a disaster declaration. On January 2nd, Kipnuk's tribe became the second ever in Alaska to receive a federal disaster declaration, according to FEMA. The first went to Wrangell's tribal government following the deadly landslide there in 2023. In Wrangell, the state of Alaska also declared a disaster. But in Kipnuk, which does not have any city government, Paul says the tribe ultimately decided it was in their best interest to deal directly with the federal side, bypassing the state. Working with tribal governments is something that FEMA Region 10 spokesperson Natalie Shaver says the agency wants to better facilitate going forward.
We've worked really hard in Region 10 to make sure we are hearing and listening to tribes and being more understanding of how our programs may or may not work and the ways what we can do to better them and make them more accessible, understanding it's government to government.
In December, FEMA made changes to the ways it interacts with tribes, including reducing the minimum amount of damage that has to happen for a tribe to be eligible for assistance from $250,000 to $100,000. So far, the native village of Kipnuk has only been approved for public assistance, which reimburses the tribe for community-wide repair work on public infrastructure like roads and public buildings.
FEMA will reimburse the village of Kipnuk for any publicly owned infrastructure or any work that was done to respond to the disaster.
The federal government covers up to 98% of the costs of public infrastructure repair.
FEMA staff will be setting up meetings with village staff in the next couple of weeks to start documenting damages to any kind of public infrastructure to see what will be reimbursed.
Applications for individual assistance are still pending, which would provide additional relief for individuals and households. Paul says her tribe was also recently selected by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency for a $20 million grant for stabilization of the banks of the Gugakluk River where Kipnuk is located. She says her greatest concern is ensuring that elders in the community who may not be able to evacuate when flooding comes are protected against an uncertain future.
We're like the forefront of all these extreme storm events happening now. I fear things are going to just get worse from here on out for the extreme storms, you know.
According to Shaver, with FEMA, a federal disaster declaration application is also pending for the native village of Guigillinock, which is located roughly 30 miles east of Kipnuk and also reported significant damage during the August floods. In Bethel, I'm Evan Erickson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing cargo transportation to 9 Alaska communities. NAC offers options including cargo charters to get freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. You can make a difference in the lives of Alaskans. Every year, hundreds of nonprofits provide warm meals, safe places, and resources to hundreds of thousands of Alaskans. By supporting Alaska's nonprofits when you apply for your PFD, you're giving more opportunity, more hope, more chances. This year, make more possible with the click of a button. Don't forget to give via PicClick Give when you apply for your PFD. This message sponsored by PicClick Give.
Winter rain has caused icy conditions across much of South Central Alaska. It led to school closures and delays today from the Kenai Peninsula through Anchorage and up to the Matsu Borough. On Monday, Anchorage hit a record high temperature of 42 degrees, a degree warmer than the previous record for this date set in 2014. National Weather Service climate researcher Brian Bretschneider says this winter, the state has seen a dominant weather pattern of southerly flows bringing warm weather from across the Pacific Ocean.
As the air flows over that really, really warm water, it warms up more than it used to. So that's one part. And then it also holds more moisture because warmer air has the capacity to hold more moisture.
Bretschneider says it's hard to pin the southerly flow of warm weather to changes due to a warming climate. However, he notes that diminished sea ice in the Arctic is adding heat to the atmosphere, and that can make it easier for storms to form. Despite the fourth snowiest October on record, roughly half of precipitation in Anchorage has been rain this winter. Bretschneider says that pattern is not unprecedented, and it's becoming more common.
It's happened before, but it's happened now three or four times, since about the year 2000. So there definitely seems to be an increase in the propensity for that to happen.
Alaska is currently in a La Nina weather pattern, which typically means cooler northerly systems coming through the state. Bretschneider says it's still possible the La Nina will bring some cool weather to the state, but for now, the forecast looks warm.
We look to be kind of in a warm pattern statewide for about the next 7 or 8 days. And then we hopefully should get back to more typical Alaska winter conditions.
Bretschneider says this winter is about 10 inches shy of the average snowfall, but he thinks the city's snowpack will survive the rainy weather. Meanwhile, last month, Bethel's library director was honored with a National Librarian Award. As KYUK's Sage Smiley reports, she's one of just 10 people in the country to receive it.
For Bethel's librarian Teresa Quiner, books have been a lifelong pursuit.
Probably a lot of librarians would say this, but it started because I really love to read. And, you know, when I was a kid, you could hardly get me out of the house because I always had my nose in a book.
Quiner has been working at the Kuskokwim Consortium Library since 2015. Within 8 months of moving to Bethel and starting to work at the library, Quiner became the director.
I really love serving this community. I feel like I get to see people from all across the community every single day when I'm at work. And it feels like a big family. Something that has just made Bethel become home for me is the strong community ties that everybody has with each other. And I get to see that like every day at work.
Quiner was selected from among more than 1,300 nominees for the American Library Association's 2025 I Love My Librarian Award. It's a community-nominated recognition of expertise, dedication, and impact on the people of a community. She says she's been hearing about the award for years. She was shocked and honored to find out she'd be getting one.
I got to see like the testimonials that people wrote in about or to nominate me, and it made me cry. It was very, very exciting to hear.
She says running a library in a remote part of Alaska can be a challenge. Off the road system and only accessible by plane, boat, or snow machine, Bethel's library faces unique logistical challenges to providing services to the community. She says the Kuskokwim Consortium Library tries to provide all the services larger libraries do, but with fewer people and resources. Bethel's library has just 3 full-time staff members.
There's just so many needs that the community has that aren't being filled. And so we're just always trying to find creative ways to help people accomplish their goals or find the information they need or connect them to resources that can help them.
The library hosts arts workshops, community events, and runs a checkout system for household items that help with subsistence food preservation, like a vacuum sealer and pressure cookers. And the library's impact extends far beyond the books and kitchen tools it loans out.
We're a third space, you know, where people can get out of their house in the winter and go without spending money, just to congregate as a community, attend a workshop or a program and be with other people. But, you know, there's not a lot of spaces like that in the community. There's churches and, you know, the fitness center requires money to go there. So I think that's just a really important part of, you know, what we provide to the community.
While Quiner is an award-winning librarian, the Kuskokwim Consortium Library itself is also an award-winning library. In 2023, it received the nation's highest honor awarded to museums and libraries, the National Medal for Museum and Library Service. With the I Love My Librarian Award, Quiner wins $5,000. She'll be formally recognized along with the 9 other award recipients at a conference in Phoenix, Arizona in late January.
With help from Mary-Kate Dolan, in Bethel, I'm Sage Smiley.
While many families around Alaska unwrapped presents in the warmth of their homes on Christmas Day, a group of surfers were paddling into 41-degree water, catching waves on the Bering Sea. KUCB's Kenesha McLaughlin-Price has the story.
Like most mornings, Tim Erickson drove out to the local surf spot in Unalaska to scope out the waves. The last few days had been choppy and windy, but he had a surprise present on Christmas Day. A glassy bay with perfect conditions.
What I like to do is I'll go up and drive up to the lookout point. To my surprise that day, I saw, two cars and two people were coming out with surfboard. And I sat there and watched it for probably a good solid 10 minutes. And within that 10 minutes, it was just nonstop, consistent, just waves peeling off of the riprap there.
Tim Erickson is a petty officer with the United States Coast Guard Marine Safety Unit in Unalaska. He describes the conditions as nothing short of a Christmas miracle.
It's like one of the most surreal surfing experiences I've ever had. You know, California's gorgeous. There's amazing waves there, but like the scenery and the wildlife, yeah, very beautiful and surprisingly great waves. Yeah.
One of the surfers Erickson saw from the lookout that morning was tugboat mate Reef Larwood. He's been working on the island for the last 4 years and still loves the beauty of the breaks.
Especially that spot with the shipwreck right there and the snow-covered mountains surrounding you. And then there's always all the sea life. You know, there was a sea lion that came up like 20 feet away from us, probably just checking us out, trying to figure out what was going on, otters and everything. Yeah, it's a cool spot to surf.
The beaches may be beautiful, but surfing in cold waters requires some serious skill. Both Erickson and Larwood have decades of experience and emphasize the importance of safety when tackling these icy waters.
I mean, one thing, hypothermia is a real thing too, so you need to have proper equipment. Like, you need to have a really good wetsuit, and you need to have a really thick wetsuit.
Erickson says having the right gear is important to not only enjoy the sport, but survive it. For Larwood, having the proper gear and training made this year's Christmas surf unforgettable.
You need a wetsuit and a wetsuit with a hood and gloves and booties. And so wetsuits are usually, the thicknesses are in millimeters. So I use a 6 millimeter wetsuit and then I have, I think, 7 millimeter booties and 7 millimeter gloves. And you want your wetsuit nice and snug, nice and tight, so water doesn't get in there too easily.
For beginner surfers, Larwood suggests starting in Summer Bay during the warmer months. The sandy bottom offers a safer environment for learning, and he recommends going with a mentor familiar with the area, which surprisingly isn't hard to find in Unalaska. In Unalaska, I'm Kenesha McGlashan-Price.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Sophia Stewart Rossi and Kenesha McLaughlin-Price in Unalaska, Evan Erickson and Sage Smiley in Bethel, and Desiree Hagen in Kotzebue. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Wesley Early. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Talk one-on-one with experts on mental health, nutrition, pharmacology, surgery, childcare, and much more on Line 1, your health connection. Weekly on your local public radio station.
Get your weekly look at the trends, policies, and issues that impact your wallet in Alaska with the Alaska Economic Report. With me, Ava White, on your local public radio station each week.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.
How can you see into my
gotta get up.
This here worrisome heart. I need a break from my troubling ways. Need a break from my troubling ways.
would be lucky to find me a man who could love me the way that I am, with all my troubling ways. Baggage to claim, I need a man who got no baggage to claim. I would be lucky to find me a man who could love me the way that I am. Worrisome, troubling, baggage-free, modern-day dame. Worrisome, troubling, baggage-free, modern-day dame. Ain't nobody the same.
The beach, eat, let's go get a wave. They say what they gonna say. Have a drink, clink, found a Bud Light. Bad like me, it's hard to come by. The Patron, oh, let's go get it down. The sound, oh, yes, I'm in the zone. Is it two, three, leave a good tip. I'ma blow all of my money and don't give
two. I'm on the floor. above the timber line, but you and I were born to roam, to wander through the whistling pine. Once the summer evening dies, our love will be of yesterday. One more glance into your eyes, then we can laugh our love away. Someday you'll find out who you are. Someday you'll be more than just a shooting star. Claimed you for its own, to put your damage on display with a steel guitar and a microphone. I hope that you will find your way someday. You'll find out who you are. Someday you'll be more than just a shooting star. But you wouldn't know it, no one's ever showed it. Nobody showed it to you, but that doesn't mean it isn't true.
About the only thing they share. I'm in secondhand smoke, still just drinking canned coke. I don't need a Zanny to feel better. Waking up at sundown, they're late to every party. Nobody's ever sorry, though inebriated now to death. Morning as they come down, their pretty heads are hurting. They're awfully bad at learning. Make the same mistakes, blame circumstance. I'm secondhand smoke, still just drinking canned coke. I don't need a Zanny to feel better. Or ever.
What is it about them? I must be missing something. They just keep doing nothing. Too intoxicated to be scared.
Hard to change, but hey, I got you down on your knees again. You watch the sky, it's a pale parade of passing clouds that cover the bed upon which we laid in the dark, and the memories that I made of a laughing girl. But you're just my toy, and I can't stop playing with you, baby. If you and you wanted to be free, there's just one thing you need to know, and that's that you can't count on me. I'm coming along real good, but I still can't do most of the things I should. I watch the sky coming down to bury me, and I can't stop this crawling out of my skin. I know that you see yourself flying in out of the sky, coming down to carry me, but I won't come out. So if you think you need to go, if you wanted to be free, there's one thing you need to know, and that's that you can't count on me. Count on me. I watch all of the same parades as they pass on the days that you wish you'd stay. But all this pain gets me high, and I get off, and you know why. So if you think you need to go, if you wanted to be free, there's one thing you need to know, and that's that you can't count.
The Yunga Tribal Council is a proud sponsor of KSDP and Aleutian Peninsula Broadcasting. Thank you for your support.
Fight for you like